You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In May of 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark headed out from St. Louis on the first leg of a voyage that would take them through what is now Nebraska, the Dakotas, Montana, over the Rocky Mountains, onto the Pacific Ocean, and back. The journey made by boat and on foot took nearly 2 years, and it ensured that Lewis, Clark, and Sacagawea would be familiar names to us now, a little harder to pronounce, nearly 200 years after they set up that Missouri River. They set out on the Missouri River. Well, Thomas Jefferson, then President of the United States, all 17 states at that time, selected Lewis to make this journey west to find a passageway across the land, a direct route from sea to sea. He was an accomplished amateur scientist himself, and Jefferson sent Lewis to the best scientific minds in the colonies to prepare Lewis for his trip, for the journey, so he would recognize and know what he was doing along the way. And Jefferson instructed the party to record the natural history they encountered and to bring back specimens of the important plants they found. For the rest of this hour, we're going to take a look at that expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, and talk about the duo as botanists. What were they looking for? What did they bring back? And what can we learn from those plant specimens 200 years later? And what was science like back in those days? We're going to talk about all of this. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can join in our discussions. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Richard M. McCord is Associate Curator of Botany at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. He joins us from member station WHYY in Philly. Thanks for being with us, Dr. McCord.
Thank you, Ira.
Dr. James L. Reveal, retired professor emeritus at University of Maryland, is also an honorary curator at the New York Botanic Garden. He joins us from the studios of member station KUNR in Reno. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Good afternoon. Carolyn Gilman is the curator of the National Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Exposition and a historian at the Missouri Historical Society. She joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello, Ira.
Hi. Let me start out by asking you, Richard McCourt, you have a very interesting line in this paper that you wrote in the Plant Science Bulletin, and you say, you know, everybody knows about this expedition, but very few people understand or realize the richest trove of natural history specimens that they brought back. Why do you think no one knows about that?
Well, nobody knew about it for about a century, it seems, anyway. They were directed to collect these specimens because that was how you did science in the 19th century and still in the 20th and 21st century, too. But when they got back, the specimens were sort of waylaid or mislaid to some extent and went through a rather circuitous route, so that some ended up being stored in a somewhat neglected room in Philadelphia for nearly 100 years. Others went across the Atlantic and finally came back and ended back up in Philadelphia. But they were written up in 1813 and then not studied to a great deal after that. So a lot of people didn't know about it. And most recently, I guess, it's just that nobody's come around to look at the plants too much, except that's changed over the past few years.
Yeah. I'd like to get into that story a little bit later. Let's retrace our roots back.
Sure.
Let's go back to Thomas Jefferson, the president at the time of this expedition. He sent them out to collect these. Why? Well, why did he think about doing that? This was not the main purpose of that expedition.
It wasn't the main purpose, but it was, to Jefferson's mind, probably one of the primary things he wanted to get back from the West was new species of plants and animals, too. But he was particularly interested in plants. He said it was his passion at various times. And he once said that the most valuable thing you could do as a citizen would be to domesticate a new species or variety of plant. So when he told Lewis to go out, he wanted him to make sure that he looked for new species of plants that might become horticulturally useful or scientifically of interest. And so he made sure that he had training for it. He sent him to Philadelphia before the trip, actually a year before 1804, in 1803, where he got kind of a crash course in botany from the leading scientist of the time, Benjamin Smith Barton, who was a professor at Penn, the University of Pennsylvania here. Mm-hmm. So he was really keenly interested in this. And remember, he was a farmer all his life, and he made notes about his plants and grew some of the plants that Lewis collected.
You just go to Monticello, you see the kind of science he was interested in. And,
exactly. It's still, yeah. They're still there. It's maintained by the people there now.
Yeah. Jim Reveal, what kind of training did he get? He had to be taught what to look for, what to see?
Well, fortunately, his mother was a herbalist, therefore well-known and well-schooled in the local plants of Virginia. Lewis actually attempted to go west as early as the 1780s when Jefferson was attempting to get an expedition across the country while in the Washington administration. So Lewis had a degree of training, and Dr. Barton helped improve that to the point that he was knowledgeable and instructed to collect the following: plants of agronomic importance, Jefferson's first passion; plants of horticultural importance, Jefferson's second passion; and then things that might be of nice nature to horticulture. So those were his basic instructions. And overlying all of these, of course, was Jefferson and Lewis's own passion of medicinal plants, plants used by the American natives.
Hmm. Carolyn Gilman, let's set the stage a little bit about plant collecting back then. Was that a common thing to do in Jefferson's day?
Yes, indeed it was. You've got to remember that these guys were part of the Enlightenment. And it was a giant project that was going on all over the world at this point, spearheaded by Euro-Americans who were spreading out over the world. They wanted to catalog and collect and classify every kind of living being on Earth. The whole idea was that by categorizing everything, they would be able to somehow reveal the purpose and the rationale behind creation. And so they were collecting not only plants, but animals, types of rocks. They were collecting data about the weather. They were collecting languages. And they were also applying some of these same methods, these rational, analytical methods, to the people that they met all around the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember, this is way before Darwin, right?
Yes, they didn't have a sense of evolution. However, they did have a theory of adaptation to environment. And this was a really crucial question that they were particularly interested in America, because, of course, a lot of organisms had moved from Europe to America. That is, people had moved into this new environment. And the question was, how was that environment going to affect them? How were they going to adapt, not only physically, but also morally and mentally?
Mm-hmm. James Reveal, where did the expedition do most of its collecting?
It first began up the Missouri River. Jefferson understandably felt that the expedition should go up the river some distance before they started to collect plants, because there were collectors nearby St. Louis. So Lewis began to collect mainly in July of 1804 in what is today Kansas and then Nebraska. Most of those collections were then sent down the river in the spring of 1805, and they reached Philadelphia through Jefferson later that year. The expedition then continued on from North Dakota into the Pacific coast in 1805, but all of the specimens up to Lemhi Pass in Idaho, Montana, were lost in the following year due to river flooding when they buried their specimens, as was common in the time, and were going to come back for them. So the material that we have, the bulk of the some 232 specimens that we have that are genuinely Lewis and Clark specimens, were gathered on the return trip in 1806.
Mm-hmm. Rick McCourt, we hear about the plants that were collected barely made it back with us today. So tell us a little bit how the plants came to end up in the herbarium at your institution at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philly. It almost didn't happen, did it?
It almost didn't. When the first winter, they sent back about 60 specimens of plants to the American Philosophical Society before they really headed out further west. Of those, 30 have been just irretrievably lost. We don't know where they are, but the other 30 were kept. Then they lost a few on the way out, as Jim mentioned. The rest they brought back and handed over to Benjamin Smith Barton. Lewis brought them back and gave them to him to study, because he was going to write up a companion natural history volume to the whole publication of the journals. Well, that never happened, because Lewis died. He committed suicide in 1809. And Barton really handed off the project to somebody else. That somebody was Frederick Pirsch, a botanist and a gardener, a working man at the time, who in Philadelphia. He studied the plants, drew pictures. He talked with Lewis once before Lewis went off to never return. and sat around waiting for things to happen. Eventually, nothing did. So he left and gave the plants eventually back to William Clark. Not unbeknownst to anyone at the time, he had taken about a third of the collection with him without permission, basically. You could say it was purloined or an unauthorized loan. I'm not sure what you would call it. But he took them with him for further study. He went all the way over to England, studied them there, and came back but left the plants in England. So they eventually, through a very interesting series of events, were almost bought by other Europeans, but at the last minute at the auction where they were sold after the gentleman died who owned them, an American bought them. And he brought back with him 47 plants, and they came to Philadelphia eventually and sat in the herbarium here for a while. Meanwhile, the rest of the plants were boxed up and placed with the American Philosophical Society, the scholarly institution established by Ben Franklin in Philadelphia. And they just sat there in that box until 1896, when another botanist rediscovered them and published an article and said, look, these things are still here, and sort of summarized what was known to them. Mm-hmm. And they all came together at the museum where I work, the Academy of Natural Sciences, so in about the 1897, 1898, and they've been there ever since. So you can see they kind of came together and dispersed and came back together again and finally they're here together. Now, there's still 9 over in England that were in a different box sold at the auction, and they're still at the Kew Gardens over there in their collection.
And, do they know that they belong to us over there?
They do. Actually, I know the director, and I sort of jokingly thought maybe this would be a good time for another loan he could give us. And we might. But he said it would take an act of parliament to actually give them back, but he'd be happy to loan them for a while. So. And with the best of intentions of returning them, we might take them up on that.
We can call them plants of mass destruction and go get them, Mike. Carolyn Gilman, tell us about it. Did Sacagawea have any influence on collecting these plants, or are the other Native Americans that they ran into?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and we don't actually know the answer to it, because Lewis didn't really write much about what his methods of collection were. But by looking at the kinds of plants he collected, you can surmise that he must have had help from Native people, because so many of the plants that he collected were used by Native Americans for basketry or for curing or for food. And many, many of those plants were collected by women. Plant collection in Indian societies was largely a female job, and often men were looked down on if they tried to do it. And so you have to wonder what the Indians thought of Lewis out there botanizing in the mountains, doing what they considered a woman's job, and consulting with the women about it, as he must have done.
And so he brought back many of the herbs. They were looking for medicinal plants and any other thing. Do you think that part of those were taken from the collections of Native Americans? Is it advised, you know, pick this, pick that?
Oh, absolutely.
The specimen of tobacco was actually an Indian-made collection. This is a plant that Lewis and Clark did not themselves collect or make. It was the actual specimens dried in the Indian village in Nebraska. Also, in 1805, Lewis mentions on a number of occasions plants of that were eaten, particularly fruit plants, that Sacagawea, or Sacagawea as you prefer, pointed out to him, and he gathered. Unfortunately, as I indicated previously, all of those have been lost.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about plants this hour on the Lewis and Clark expedition on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Very interesting topic. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Rochelle in Monroe Township, New Jersey. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi there, Ira. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I really enjoy your show, and this is a particular...
Well, did we lose you? Rochelle is on the cell phone, I'll bet. All right. I know it from my screen what she wants to ask or wants to make the point. Rochelle, are you there? Now, she said she wants to tell students who are thinking of doing this kind of adventure on their own, I guess, tell students that the expedition was very dangerous. Carolyn, very dangerous. No map, no nothing.
Well, to a certain extent, they knew where they were going. But yes, she's right. They did face many dangers, not only from the physical landscape, but also from the people that they were going to meet, because they didn't know what kind of reception they were going to get from these native peoples, who had formed images of Euro-Americans in their minds that that didn't always dispose them well toward meeting Euro-Americans.
Mm-hmm. Was when they started sending the plants back and bringing them back, was Jefferson happy with what he was getting? How did he react? Yeah.
When Jefferson received the plants in 1805, he went through them and then sent the material up to Philadelphia. So he actually went through the material himself and apparently removed some of the seeds, because we know that some things were grown before Lewis returned and gave him more seeds in 1807. As for the material that Lewis brought back in 1807, that appears to have gone directly to Philadelphia through Washington. And I can only imagine what it must have been like when Lewis went through the specimen showing Jefferson this or that. Mm. Hmm. Rick, must have been quite a time in the White House.
I'll bet. Rick McCord, are there any plants now grown from those seeds still in existence?
From the seeds, they're probably not still in existence. There are some garden specimens that were grown up and then pressed for safekeeping and or sort of vouchering. There's a perhaps apocryphal story of some plants here in Philadelphia, though, that are descendants directly from some of the material they brought back. There's something called the Osage orange, which is a tall, very straight tree that produces these lumpy grapefruit-like fruits that are fairly large and mm-hmm. can fall on your head. But there are some very large old trees, a whole nice straight row of them at St. Peter's Churchyard here in Philadelphia. And they won't let me core them. I'm not sure if I could tell the dates from that anyway. But we're not sure if they're big enough to be 200 years old, but they could be descendants of some of the original cuttings that were sent back from the St. Louis area by Lewis, because it was one of the species he collected or was given, and he pressed a specimen of it. So we have it in the herbarium, and we have the living stuff nearby.
Well, could you do DNA analysis? Grab one of those leaves and say, hey, you know?
I think you probably could. It's not finely tuned in the botanical world the way it is for humans, where you and I could be differentiated pretty quickly if we were at a crime scene or not. But I think it is possible. We're investigating that, but as you can imagine, we don't want to take a little piece of the leaf of Lewis and Clark plants and destroy them unless we're pretty darn sure we can get a good answer from it. So there are a number of things that would be interesting to test that way. Jim just rediscovered a species of a tobacco that was thought to be extinct for the last 80 years or so, and we're trying to figure out ways of doing that kind of test with that as well. It's a cultivated variety of tobacco that's very different from the Virginia type, and maybe it was kept alive for that 80 years or several hundred years through a continuous line, that should be testable, yeah. And you can get DNA from the herbarium specimens. It turns out that next to freezing, drying something is the best way to preserve the DNA in it.
Wow.
And these are sure dry.
All right. We're going to talk lots more after we take this break with Richard McCourt, James Reveal, and Carolyn Gilman about the Lewis and Clark anniversary. And take your calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the science, the botany of Lewis and Clark, with my guest, Dr. Richard McCourt, Associate Curator of Botany at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, Dr. James L. Reveal, retired Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland. He's also an honorary curator at the New York Botanical Garden, Carolyn Gilman, curator of the Lewis and Clark, the National Bicentennial Exhibition, and a historian at the Missouri Historical Society. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Carolyn, they brought back lots more than just, we're talking about the botany, but they collected a lot more stuff than just the flora, right? There are a lot of fauna that they were brought back with.
Yeah, these guys weren't specialists. They were generalists, and they were out looking for all sorts of science. In the national exhibition that we put together, we have examples of all of the tools and the specimens that they would have collected. They brought back zoological specimens. There's a battered a body of a Lewis's woodpecker that they collected and brought back. There are mineral specimens. Unfortunately, there's only four left. There were originally 70. There are vocabulary sheets that they used to collect Indian words and in order to be able to analyze languages and come up with a theory on the origins of the Indians. And then there were navigational instruments, what they called mathematical instruments, that they used to measure the land. There were also books. They did not base their science just on their own knowledge. They brought along an entire reference library full of books on minerals and plants and animals, and they had a four-volume encyclopedia with them. Hmm. So this was they set out as a research project.
Is any of this stuff open to the public to see this now?
Yes.
See these things?
At the Missouri Historical Society in St. Louis, currently you can see some of the botanical specimens. We've got four botanical specimens on exhibit at any one time, and then all of the mineral and the zoological specimens as well.
Is there a traveling exhibit going around?
Yes. The exhibit is going to be in St. Louis until September 6th, and then it will be going to Philadelphia, where it will be going to the Academy of Natural Sciences, opening in November. And then it will go to Denver, and then to Portland, and then back to Washington, D.C., where it will close in 2006. So people all across the country will get a chance to see the science of Lewis and Clark.
To see these artifacts, this is, I think, to me, as fascinating as seeing dinosaur bones, you know?
Oh, yeah. To see the plants that Lewis actually picked in 1806 is just astonishing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And go ahead.
I was going to say that the specimens themselves are quite interesting. Scientifically, they're still interesting to botanists, of course, but just to the general visitors that come through, we do some behind-the-scenes tours and show them occasionally. It really does kind of take a lot of people's breath away because they have associated with them little tags and pieces of scientific graffiti, if you will, over the years, some of which were just written in the 1890s, and probably the people at the time didn't think that they were part of this ongoing saga that would be hundreds of years in the making. But there are little pieces of paper with Meriwether Lewis's handwriting on them and Frederick Pursh's handwriting. Lewis would write about some field note on this little blotter paper that was probably going to be thrown away someday, he thought. And you can see what he was thinking and what he was writing about and what the Native Americans were telling him in many cases. So it's really fascinating. It is like the dinosaur bones. There's nothing quite like the real thing. You can read a description of it in the journals, but seeing the plants as they really were is pretty fascinating.
Now, a lot of the specimens, have been lost over the years. And I remember reading someplace, somebody was telling me that that they've been going around because someone found one of Lewis and Clark's handwritten labels at a tag sale someplace or at a garage sale.
Yeah, that's true. Gary Moulton, who is the most recent editor of the journals, about every 100 years somebody will edit them thoroughly, and Gary's done that, and so there's a multi-volume workout, and he has his own label. Somebody found it at maybe a garage sale or something like that, picked up the little purple tag like the ones I was talking about with Lewis's handwriting on it, and they gave it to Gary as a gift, so he has it in his house. And presumably it'll go to a museum someday. And there are papers that are discovered. I'm sure Carolyn can tell you a story of even in the past decade or a few decades, they keep finding letters here and there by Clark and artifacts.
Carolyn?
Yeah, at the Peabody Museum just a few months ago, they discovered a bear claw necklace that they hadn't known they had. It had gotten miscatalogued, and they had known that originally Lewis and Clark donated a bear claw necklace, but they didn't know where it was, and then they found it in the Pacific Ocean collection. That just in the last couple months has turned up, so you just
curator's
never know.
He did bring back
curator's nightmare.
He did bring back a piece of seaweed, didn't he?
Yes,
actually, that's very little known. I gave a talk about it because I study algae, and so I said Lewis and Clark discovered the algae, or just one of them anyway. They were collecting a lot of things, though, and this was close enough to it was in a freshwater estuarine kind of habitat that they picked it up and brought it back, and it turned out that it had actually already been collected a few years earlier by a seacoast ship explorer.
Right.
But they got it.
Can we learn, Rick, anything about the environment, what it was like? Is it locked up in the plants that he brought back still?
It seems to be. We had a request a few years ago, which we thought was kind of insane at first. Somebody wanted to take samples from the plants and basically destroy little tiny pieces of them. But the rationale was a good one, and you actually can understand it. This is the earliest verifiably located and annotated collection of plants from Western North America. And so Mark Tease, who worked at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, wanted to take small pieces of leaf tissue from specimens that had a lot of it and wasn't going to damage them, and incinerate them, basically, and look at the gases that were coming off. Now, when a plant photosynthesizes, when it grows, it incorporates carbon dioxide from the air around it, and when it dies, its tissues reflect something of the constitution of the atmosphere where it grew. And by doing the appropriate isotopic analyses, you can look at the carbon dioxide concentration in Western North America at the time the plants were growing. And not surprisingly, it was a lot lower. But perhaps of more interest, and this is an idea Jim has had for a while, Jim Reveal, we've got tens of thousands of plants in collections in our museum and elsewhere that have been collected over the past several hundred years from all over the United States and elsewhere. And if this kind of study proves to be fruitful enough, you could really get some interesting information on climate change over a long period of time.
Jim, so you could make a connect the dots graph on the CO2 level over the last
century. That's the idea.
Yeah. Interesting.
When you go back and take a look at what Lewis collected of real plants, those of us who work on flowering plants and non-algae, he got 202 different kinds of plants, of which 199 are ferns or gymnosperms or flowering plants. And of that number, Persh considered 87 of those to be new to science. So as Caroline indicated, they took along a great library with them, but almost more than a third of the flora was unknown to them. And of course, disappointingly for us who work with these old collections, is to realize from Lewis's notes and writings what we don't have, because some of the most widespread plants in the American West, like sagebrush, they certainly collected, but there's no specimen. And even those specimens that they did collect sometimes are so fragmentary today that there's only a stem. Hmm. And in one case, there is just a note on the specimen which says, all gone.
So we need an international look into your collections for old things you don't think you know what they're from and find us those pieces for that they might turn up to be, you know, and in your garages and attics.
It could be useful. The thing is, you don't always know where to look.
Yes, please. Somebody in Philadelphia, if label number 26 showed up in the autograph market, that means that probably the first 30 plants are in someone's attic in Philadelphia. Please check.
And yes, I mean, that's a serious request.
That is a serious request.
Yeah. All right, we're going to find on Science Friday these old plants. That'll be our mission for the next year. We're talking about plants from the Lewis and Clark expedition this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And sometimes it's just that simple, right? Just as you mentioned, just turning the bear claw necklace turned up. You never know what's going to turn up, Sarah. All right, let's go to Sarah in Cleveland. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Is it me?
Well, I guess it is. You're not Sarah, are you?
I am Sarah.
I'm sorry.
I have a cold and I'm also so I can barely hear, but thank you.
I addressed the last question to you, but I guess you couldn't hear me.
I was just going to comment, as your earlier guest remarked, I saw the bear claw necklace in a magazine recently, and there's for Lewis and Clark history lovers, there's an exhibition called From Nation to Nation, Reexamining Lewis and Clark's Indian Collection, currently going on at the Peabody Museum in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And another major purpose of the trip, according to Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, besides collecting all these plants, which I read years ago, and maybe one of your guests can confirm or deny my memory, that I think one of the two ate some of the plants collected and got pretty sick, didn't he? Did Lewis do that, mm-hmm. or Clark?
You're probably thinking about the camas plant.
Oh.
And that turns out to be nonsense, of course, because as near as we can tell, when we were writing our book on the Lewis and Clark's Green World, both Scott Earle and myself, we went and tested this hypothesis that this is what caused the illness, and we both concluded it was the dried salmon that that they were eating.
It's always the fish.
And you can imagine the sense behind this, because here we are about ready to go into winter, in the winter of 1805. And do you think the Native Americans would be giving away their best food to these bunch of guys that just showed up?
No, especially since I was starting to say earlier, too, that another purpose was to explain to the Native Americans that their new landlord was Jefferson and not the French, and most of them didn't seem to know they had a landlord, so that was kind of interesting. But thank you for taking my call.
Thank
Great
you,
show.
Sarah. Thank Bye. You. Hope you feel better. Did they sample a lot of the stuff before they took it back?
The plant name for Lewis, Lewisia rediviva, Lewis tasted and considered it disgusting. And I've tasted it, and it is disgusting to my taste. But it was a warmly received food for the Native Americans in Idaho and Montana.
Yeah,
they did eat a lot of the plants at various times, and they were given good advice about that. Even it wasn't always tasty by the Native Americans. Camas plants, as Carolyn mentioned, they basically saved their lives or came close to it, I think, after they made the trip over the mountains and almost starved in the Lolo Pass. They ate a lot of camas when they came back. It's a root that's the Indians showed them how to bake for several days in steamed rocky pits and buried underground, and then you can store it for a number of years after that. So they ate a lot of plants, and it was very important, obviously, to their diet to eat more than just 20 pounds of buffalo a day or whatever it was they were eating.
Carolyn Gilman?
Yeah, you've got to remember that, of course, they were having to purchase their food for 3 years from the Indians. And so they ate what the Indians ate. So they were introduced to a great many new foods by the people who hosted them, not just camas, but cows and the bitterroot that Dr. Reveal mentioned. There were other plants along the Pacific coast that they learned to eat that were completely new to them and that are no longer eaten today by the people who live there, except that the Indian tribes sometimes, maintain the tradition of eating traditional foods. But, they were subsisting off the land, and so, of course, they ended up ingesting a lot of the land.
Yeah. And they smoked some of it, too. They smoked that tobacco, and they had some berberry, I think it was called, that they used to cut the tobacco. It was kind of leathery leaves. I'm not sure what it would be like since I don't smoke. But so they were consuming things, and they didn't dislike all of it. I guess we give that impression. But they had a lot of berries and currants that were really delicious, too.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the currants were a great favorite, and it's interesting that many of the currants or gooseberries that were introduced into the East by Lewis and Clark went quickly into Europe, and you can walk around some of the small parks in London and Geneva and still see the original introductions of Lewis and Clark plants.
Well, I wish we could had more time. We could go on talking about this all day. I want to thank my guests. Dr. Richard McCourt, his associate curator of botany at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. James Reveal, retired professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. He's also the honorary curator at the New York Botanical Garden. Carolyn Gilman, curator of the Lewis and Clark, the National Bicentennial Exhibition, which is going to be traveling around. It's at the Museum of History now through September. It's going to move to Philly, Denver, Portland, and Washington, D.C., so watch out for it. I know I'm going to try to see if I can get a look at it. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Gaelic, Enrico Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And if you missed any of the references we made, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, any of the stuff we talked about. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.